Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
This episode contains descriptions of gun violence and suicidal ideation. If you or someone you know are having mental health struggles, you can call or text 988 at any time or visit 988lifeline.org.
When I was laying there, you know, I was really thinking about my family and how much I needed to hold on for them.
In 2014, Rani Ahmed was a biomedical engineering student at Florida State University.
I was pretty low-key. I didn't really go out too much or anything like that. Most of my time was kind of spent in the library. I want to say that was the semester I was taking physical chemistry, calc, like really, really demanding, difficult, kind of like the higher level classes. So that was a tough semester.
Oof. Why would you do that to yourself?
They kind of require it. Even with me taking 5-6 classes at a time, it was still a 5-year course.
The night of November 20th, 2014, Rani went out to a rave. Just kidding. He was in the library studying.
We were 2 weeks away from the physics final. We had a homework due that night at 12. And my buddy had asked me if we wanted to go outside, take a quick break before we continued studying, because we'd been there since, I want to say, at least 7 or 8, if not earlier. Right in front of the library, there's like some tables, some sitting area underneath the trees and stuff like that. It's really nice. We were over there just talking, and there was 3 of us initially, me, my friend, and then my friend's friend. And my friend had gone back inside to continue studying after a couple minutes, and we had stayed outside just for a little bit longer before heading in.
And then, out of nowhere,
I heard this pop, which isn't too typical. So I was just thinking like, oh man, I guess a car like ran over something like that. So I kind of like look over in that direction and see if I can, you know, see what's going on. And I see some smoke rising in the air. And I'm like, okay, that's weird. Because it's like right in front of the library. And I see this person walking towards our direction. And there's like these bushes that kind of like perpendicular to the front of the library. So I see him coming around the bushes, and first thing I notice is just how stern his face is. No emotion, just not angry, but just very just emotionless. And then I saw in his hand, there was silver. You could just see the top of the silver from the gun.
This is Live to Tell, the podcast where I talk to some of the bravest people who have been through the most horrifying things and lived to tell the tale. I'm Caitlin Van Maul.
I don't know. I guess I kind of put it together pretty quick. So I was trying to turn. There was, there was a big tree off to our side. And I was going to turn to run behind that tree. But before I even had time to turn, he had already shot me twice. So the first one hit my stomach, hit my T11 vertebra. It affects up to my T10 though. So that paralyzed me instantly. Because I was in the process of turning to my left, I was paralyzed, but my body still had the momentum of turning to the left. So I started collapsing while turning. And then as I was falling, the second bullet went through my arm, mm-hmm. broke my humerus, and then it actually continued through my arm, broke two of my ribs, and that was resting up against my heart. So I hit the ground, and, you know, I didn't necessarily know the extent of the damage, but I knew that I was very damaged. And, you know, for example, I, you know, wouldn't be laying on the ground for no reason.
Right.
So I looked up at my friend's friend and I said, call 911. So they call 911. I think they're kind of finally coming to out of the shock. They hand me their phone and he runs off. So I'm there by myself at this point. And at that point, I looked down at my arm and I picked it up. And from about right here,
Ronnie is pointing to about 2 inches above his elbow.
It was just hanging. I mean, this entire thing was just hanging down here. And the bone was trying its best to poke out the skin this way. And, you know, I was an Eagle Scout, so I was pretty practiced in emergency preparedness and what to do in an emergency situation and all that kind of stuff. So I'm just trying to quickly get them all the information that they could possibly need. Hey, you know, the shooting at the school in front of the library. They were like, who's been shot? And I was like, well, me.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, okay. We're sending officers there right now. And I was like, hey, I'm going to hang up and call my mom. And they were like, no, sir, please do not do that. Do not hang up the phone. I'm sitting there thinking about it. And I'm like, you know, this isn't even my phone. I don't know what's going to happen if I hang up, if it's going to be locked or what. You know, I don't even know if I'm going to be able physically to call my mother. And honestly, probably for the best that I didn't. I don't think any mother needs to hear that.
Yeah.
As much as I wanted to talk to her.
But yeah, I mean, you want your mom. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very natural.
And did you know where the shooter was?
I'd seen him walk into the library at that point, I want to say. Thankfully, they had just done practice, you know, active shooter practice, essentially the week before. So thankfully, they had like a 2-minute, 15-second, 30-second response time, which is pretty solid, all considering.
Yeah, that's super fast.
Yeah, they were there very quickly. So the first officer comes up and, you know, I just hand him the phone. I was just like, I don't want to deal with this anymore. Like, you know, I like asked him a couple questions and then he went to go deal with the guy.
So Ronnie had to just lie there and wait.
Just thinking about how like surreal it all was. So like one of the interesting things is I've suffered from depression for a long time, well before I was injured.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of suicidal ideation and stuff like that. But then sitting there bleeding out in front of the library thinking like, man, is this really how I'm going to die? Like, in front of the library and a school shooting. Mostly what I remember thinking of is my family's never going to recover from this. You know, we're not wealthy. They're not exactly the most well-equipped, let's say, from past experiences and stuff like that, of trauma and hardship and stuff like that. And then just the monetary cost, medical cost, even if I did survive, funeral costs, if I didn't, you know, all of that was going through my head, just thinking like, man, how do we recover from something like this?
Ronnie didn't know if he would make it to when the paramedics got there.
At that point, a couple other officers had shown up and they had surrounded him.
And you can see all this happening.
Yeah, I can only see the cops. I can't really see him.
Yeah.
I think because they made a circle around him, kind of like boxed him in. So I can see the back of cops and I can hear them yelling at him. And they're going, freeze, drop your weapon, drop your weapon, drop your weapon. And then I think after the third time, they just unloaded. Hit him like 22, 23 times out of like the 27, 28 bullets they fired or whatever it was. So he was, you know, dealt with very, very quickly.
The shooter was killed at the scene. Paramedics rushed to tend to Ronnie, load him in the ambulance, and get him to the hospital.
I remember thinking, okay, I'm in the hospital. I'm still alive. That's pretty much the best case scenario for this situation. And then I passed out.
When he woke up, his parents and sister were already there.
My mom was really messed up. My dad, probably even more so. My sister is kind of like me. We've always been very good about doing what needs to be done. So for her, that meant dealing with all of the people, dealing with all the paperwork, dealing with the press. You know, she did like a press conference, I think, at one point, like when people wanted an update on what was going on. You know, my mom was absolutely and still probably in no position to talk about that stuff. So she took the reins and took care of everything.
Though the shooter was killed at the scene and there would be no trial, the police still needed to take a statement from Ronnie.
The police came and did a report pretty soon after that.
And what did they tell you at that time?
They didn't really tell me much. There was more of them asking me what I saw and just giving a witness testimony. I gave them the best description that I could, which wasn't correct, which I thought was interesting afterwards.
You weren't really paying attention to him.
Yeah.
And then you got shot. And then I imagine you were more focused on being shot than let me really get a good look at this guy. How did you describe him?
So, oddly enough, for whatever reason, my brain put in one of my classmates,
Interesting.
put their face as his face. And because when I saw a picture of him, I was like, oh, wow, that's not the face I remember. And I thought about it and I was like, oh, that was my biology two lab classmate or something like that. Like that. Wow, that's weird. But yeah, memory is not perfect.
The shooter was Myron May, a 31-year-old Florida State alum who, until just a month prior to the shooting, was a prosecutor in New Mexico. His friends and girlfriend noticed that his mental health was deteriorating. He was paranoid, and he had checked into mental health facilities more than once, but was released within days. Three people were wounded in the shooting, though Ronnie's injuries were by far the worst. Can I ask? So obviously he died on the scene,
Yep.
the shooter.
Myron. Yep.
When did you learn sort of about him in general?
When I was in the ICU, I don't remember exactly what point, but I do remember like going on my phone or something like that and reading about it. I definitely remember doing like a full dive, reading his manifesto, reading about him, listening to people's stories about him, stuff like that.
Did that help or hurt?
Neither. Just kind of is what it is. The one thing that I always tell people, because something that I very often hear, which makes me sad, honestly, people will say, oh, well, thank God he's dead. Or like, oh, I'm sure you're glad he's dead. And it's just like, why would that make me feel better? He wasn't a psychopath. He wasn't a murderer. He wasn't this malicious, evil person. He was someone with a severe mental disorder who did not ever receive the help that he needed and deserved, in my opinion. And because of our healthcare system, government, and society, not only am I paralyzed, but this guy's now dead.
Being the survivor of a school shooting, Ronnie is deeply affected by every school shooting that has happened since.
And I get that there's no way that this would have ever happened with my situation, but the Parkland situation, the Uvalde situation, the fact that we can't get common sense gun legislation passed is so aggravating. All these people pretend to care. They love to posture, they love to virtue signal, they love to pat themselves on the back. It makes me so angry because I've spent my whole life trying to help make the world a better place, whatever that means. And these people who are supposed to be taking care of us, these people who were supposed to be making the decisions, supposed to be protecting us, supposed to be allocating resources so things like this are either don't happen or at least taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what happens. None of those people who should care do anything.
And a lot of the people who don't want to pass the common sense gun laws mm-hmm. are like, well, then, you know, it's our mental health,
yep.
which is what happened in your case.
Yep. And he did not get the help he needed.
And what are you doing about that then?
Not a thing.
Ronnie had to go through intense rehabilitation and had to accept he would never walk again.
So because I was biomedical engineering, I had a pretty intimate understanding of what physically happened to me and the implications and stuff like that. So that was obviously a lot and frustrating and overwhelming. But overall, especially the first year, I was pretty okay with it because I've had a very privileged life. I've gotten to do a lot of things that people only dream about, you know, visiting places, doing things, all kinds of stuff that my parents provided for me. So while it was a crappy situation, I had done so much with my life by the time I was 21, it didn't really bother me that much. You know, I was just happy to be there with my family. And, you know, like I was saying, especially that first year, everyone is so supportive, so helpful, so almost like helicopter parent, you know, mm-hmm. really just waiting for anything that you need, that it's very easy in my mind to deal with it all.
But that initial burst of support from the community, the rallies, the fundraisers, the messages of support, it all eventually faded away. Ronnie went back to school the following fall with a full course load, which he knows now was much too much too soon. And on top of that, he found that the campus was really not wheelchair accessible.
Yeah, you know, I don't hold any negative feelings towards them because I know they were doing their best.
Mm-hmm.
But it is extremely frustrating to be at one of the most networked and funded universities probably in the world. And it's like no one really cared.
Mm.
They didn't have accessible anything, honestly. The classrooms were hardly accessible. I stopped showing up to class for a while because there was nowhere for me to sit.
Mm.
I would go into the class and all the students had their nice little, you know, pre-made desks that, you know, fold over the writing table and whatnot. I couldn't get into those chairs. And then the tables that they had for disabilities were so heavy and set into the rows. What am I supposed to do? Pull the table out, back into it, and then pull the table to me, and then do the reverse on every day when I wanted to leave? So I would sit in the corner by myself with my service dog and just feel like a outcast, you know, piece of trash, just refuse, just taking up space on their pretty campus. So I stopped showing up to school. And I can't remember why a police officer showed up here, but something had happened and I was upset. And this officer that I'm pretty good friends with, Officer Gio, really nice guy, came and talked to me. And I think they wanted to Baker Act me, is what it was.
The Baker Act in Florida allows families, healthcare providers, and law enforcement officers to seek emergency mental health services for people that can't get help themselves, can't take care of themselves, or could be a harm to themselves or others. They are held at a Baker Act receiving facility for a minimum of 3 days.
This officer that I'm pretty good friends with, Officer Gio, really nice guy, came and talked to me. Disrupting my life isn't going to help me. And I kind of explained to him, yeah, How would you feel if you had to live like this? If you were treated like this every day? If you were ignored all the time? And he was just like, you know, I'm so sorry. I'm going to take care of this personally. And he was really nice. And he did. He did move the table and like talk to the department and be like, hey, do not put that table back there. You leave this table right here so that it's accessible. And they did move it back. And he had to come back out again and tell them. And I think he just physically moved it himself, honestly.
We'll be right back. Though Ronnie found accessibility on campus severely lacking, the university did come through for him in one big way.
They got me my car. And that is a big deal. That is a very big deal. But in the total scheme of things,
a functional desk.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I would give up the car for all of those other things happily.
Did they ever talk to you or ask you, like, hey, what can we do?
Yeah, they did. And that's how we came to find out that they couldn't find housing for me. Mm. They were going to put me in an assisted living home, which for someone like me would have just, I probably wouldn't be here now, frankly.
Like most college towns, housing in general was a competitive market, let alone accessible housing. So finding Ronnie fully accessible housing that would allow him to live a full life became finding Ronnie housing that could work, I guess.
The first dorm that they put me into was actually pretty nice. My mom was able to stay with me. It was on campus. It was on the first floor, you know, door right to the outside and whatnot. It was actually very, very nice and convenient. However, after we had to move out of that one, the next one that they put me in was terrible because they put me with someone else. So instead of living with my mom, I had to live with a college student. This person was an absolute slob. It was so disgusting. I didn't even feel comfortable showering in that building or in that room. It was just trash and garbage everywhere. You know, they were trying to find off-campus housing and there just was nothing available. So I just kept living at the house I had been living in. So before I was injured, I was living in that house with some people and I just moved back in with them. And you know, everyone was like, oh, this is a terrible idea, yada, yada. And parts of it was, sure. But also like,
in a sea of terrible options, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Pick the best.
Exactly. So it wasn't ideal, but at least I got to hang out with my friends. At least I got to talk with people. At least I wasn't stuck in a room by myself.
Ronnie's family was very supportive of his recovery, and his mom even moved to Tallahassee from Orlando to take care of him. But being from different generations and in many ways different cultures, Ronnie's parents are both from Bangladesh, meant having different outlooks on talking about what happened.
So I was having a difficult time with school and everything. I was failing engineering and, you know, everyone kind of like left me at that point. All my friends were gone and graduated and kind of moved on with their own lives. It was at this point where my family was too traumatized and just messed up from everything to help me. And my sister had even kind of stopped talking to me at that point, which hurt, obviously, because I was just so angry that everyone had abandoned me. You know, every now and then my mom would be like, hey, let's go out to dinner. And she's sitting there, you know, trying her best to talk to me, get me to say something. So I start telling her what it's like to be disabled on a college campus, how much it sucks and how people treat me and all of it. And her response was, who do I need to call? And I just shut down. I just completely stopped talking at that point. I was just like, don't worry about it, Mom.
Listen to my problem, not fix my problem.
Exactly. That's exactly the feeling that, yeah, there's no phone call that's going to fix any of these problems.
Yeah, just say, that sucks. I'm so sorry that's happening to you.
Yeah, and I think that was really hard for them as parents. You can't help me with this.
Yeah.
And you can be supportive, but you're not going to fix it. There's no fixing something like this.
Was there someone that you could talk to about all this, all these changes, all these feelings?
No, not really. I was seeing maybe like an individual therapist and then a group therapist. So I was talking a lot, but no one that really understood, or I don't know how to word it because I don't want to be like reductive to people that genuinely did try to help me. But trained professionals, PhDs, couldn't understand, like had a hard time with even the surface level stuff, to the point where I was almost educating them.
Ronnie learned pretty quickly that most people generally don't know what to say to someone who has experienced such a tragedy, even if their intentions were good.
But I could at least tell that it was genuine. Even if they didn't know what to say to me, even if they didn't know how to react to what I was saying.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to respond.
And a lot of people, when big things happen, or when you are going through a depressive episode, they don't know what to say. Because honestly, there is nothing to say. It's just, there's nothing to help other than, I don't know, just like watch a movie with me, you know?
Yeah, just be there, exist there with the person. That's all you really can do. Like, that's one of the things that I really had to, like, especially with group therapy. You know, you always introduce yourself and kind of like let everyone know, like, hey, this is why I'm here. This is what I'm working on, yada, yada, yada. And I get it. You know, I don't hold any resentment towards anyone that has said this towards me. So if anyone's, you know, hears this, I hope no one thinks that. But I have to constantly reassure people. I have to constantly affirm people, like, hey, we can talk about this. It's okay. It's fine. It's fair. The one that people will always try to say is, oh, it's nothing compared to what you've been through. And it's like, we weren't even talking about that. We're talking about your problems right now.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need to bring up my situation or trauma.
This isn't like the sadness Olympics.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's no winning with that kind of stuff. You know, like, everyone's suffering is valid, and like having to just like remind them, like, you don't need to downplay your hardships.
Ronnie got a very interesting bit of advice that helped him with his feelings of abandonment and frustration with how little help he was getting.
There's a person here who works with the university, has a group for people with disabilities.
This is Dr. J.R. Harding, a two-time quadriplegic and a business professor at FSU and member of Delta's advisory board on disability.
And, you know, I'd started getting my life together. I'd started going to the gym and eating better and taking care of myself and all that kind of stuff. And he was just kind of like talking to me. He was just like, yeah, you know, you're doing really well. Like, I can see how much better you're doing and whatnot. Like, I'm glad to see it. And he like leans in and starts whispering to me, that's the secret. No one cares. And I was just like, oh, that's how you get everything done, is you just do it yourself because no one is going to care about it more than you. So that was very eye-opening. And I've definitely like wrestled with those thoughts quite a bit since then.
I mean, the no one cares thing, it's just, I mean, people do care. There are people that care about you. There are people that will drop everything to come and help. But like the world at large, it's that thing of like better to expect the worst. And then if that doesn't happen, that's great.
Yeah.
Than to expect things from people and then they'll just let you down.
That was the hardest part for me because, you know, I'm fully aware of like my situation and everything. And, you know, I told you how much my family meant to me, how much my friends mean to me, you know, how much my animals mean to me. You know, I'm a very sentimental and emotional guy. So to sit there and like pour your heart out like time and time again. And, you know, it's not like my mom doesn't care. You know, like she wouldn't move all the way to Tallahassee from Orlando if she didn't care, but she's not capable of doing more for me.
It's a hard lesson to learn that the people we love maybe can't fulfill all our needs. But there are people that have come into Ronnie's life that have introduced him to things he might not have experienced otherwise.
So when I was at Tallahassee Memorial Hospital in the neuro ICU, there were therapy dogs coming by, and I love animals. You know, this lady comes into to my room with this golden retriever named Bodie. You know, I'm like interacting with him, having a good time. Super, super great dog. One of the best dogs I've ever met. And Gabrielle was talking to my sister. She was telling her like, oh yeah, you know, he's an Eagle Scout. He loves the outdoors. He loves nature. He loves animals. Like, so she comes over and starts talking to me, and she was like, hey, have you ever been scuba diving? And I was like, no. What do you mean? Like, I can't use my legs. How would I go scuba diving? And she was like, no, no, no. I specialize in teaching people with disabilities and veterans. Here's my number. Call me when you're back from rehab. I promise I will get you certified. So I spent a month and a half, 2 months, whatever it was, at rehab. Very short period compared to some people.
I know, it's not very long.
Yeah, because I was on scholarship. So every day that I spent there was scholarship money getting taken away from other people. Yeah, it's a shitty situation, but I get it.
Yeah,
they gotta
yes.
help as many people as they can.
Sure, but to then put that pressure on you to like, okay, I gotta get well as fast as possible so someone else can get the spot.
Oh, I definitely rushed it. I went back to school too early. I came back to my home too early. I did everything too early.
Okay, but back to that scuba thing. Ronnie kept Gabrielle's card, and when he was ready, he called her to start scuba training.
We started doing pool sessions at the Leech Gym at FSU. And it was actually really cool because her dive master was my economics professor. It was really cool because he took me skydiving.
Wow. After a couple of months training with Gabrielle's team, Ronnie certified as an HSA diver.
Handicap Scuba Association. That's one of the programs that does disability diving, essentially.
Ronnie did so well with that, he also got certified as an SEI diver, which is the certification able-bodied people would get.
But yeah, Gabrielle, I mean, I can't begin to list everything that Gabrielle has done for me. She got me certified as a scuba diver, gave me a job, essentially, bought me a bike, paid for therapy. Only person that's been able to find me volunteer work. So I was going to a career counselor at FSU, and I was looking for any kind of volunteer work, just anything to take up my time, because I was failing engineering at the time. School was just a mess. My life was a mess, and I just needed something to do to not feel so bad all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went to their career counseling center, and I went through their entire website. I went through all their different programs, and there really wasn't anything for me. She ended up getting me volunteer work at the Tallahassee Museum, where I got to do a bunch of stuff that I actually cared about, from working with animals, helping them organize and educate the kids that were coming through.
Gabrielle also got him started in the animal therapy program at the hospital where they met.
So the idea of being able to take Wallace to the animal therapy program, I was like, wow, like what a full circle. This is going to be so cool. And unfortunately, their insurance doesn't allow the use of medical marijuana. So Wallace passed with flying colors. You know, we'd been going for like 4 or 5 months. He passed the final exam flying colors. He had no problems with anything. So it was just so sad.
Wait, so they like drug tested you?
Yeah. And I gave them my medical card. I gave them my medical Florida card that says you are allowed to use this medicine. And they just said no. They said I'm a liability.
The legalization of marijuana was on the ballot in Florida in the 2024 election, but it didn't pass. Though Ronnie has obviously not had an easy time the last 10 years, he graduated from FSU in 2024. But seeing other people in the disability community struggle to find work, he's not sure what's next for him.
Because I know plenty of people in the community who have a degree and do nothing with it. Because no one wants to hire them. Engineers, computer scientists, but our society, our culture doesn't care. As a matter of fact, this is one of those things that a lot of people don't even realize. Most people with disabilities are forced into poverty. It's not, I actually know, I mean, obviously there's some people who are just physically incapable of working. That is absolutely true. But I know far more people in the community that want to work, but can't, because for every dollar that they make, they get like 50 cents or whatever it is taken away from their SSI. So you're working, you know, these jobs to get paid less than the average person, essentially.
Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, gives monthly income to people with disabilities.
The full amount is $946 for Florida, I think.
It's actually $943.
Who can survive on that? That doesn't pay for rent.
No.
That doesn't pay for my food. That doesn't pay for anything. It doesn't pay for my medical supplies. So, like, it is very normal for people in our situation to just be destitute. Okay. So what would it take to incentivize me to go back to work? It would either have to be incredibly worthwhile, emotionally fulfilling, or something along the lines of that, or I'd have to get paid a buttload of money. So for us, I think it would have to be like at least like 70 grand a year or something like that. And that's not a normal job. That's a specialty job. I don't, you know, how specialty, I guess you could argue that, but you know, $70,000-$80,000 a year is not even close to minimum wage.
Yeah. Oh no. Does that feel possible?
For me, yeah. But I'm a special case. I'm not even close to being the typical case of people with disabilities, let alone ones with, you know, mental disabilities and things of that nature. You know, like that's completely unfair, cruel, and kind of just disgusting as a society, frankly. So, you know, my hope is I want to take the GRE. I want to go back to grad school. I'd like to do molecular biology or something along the lines of that as a PhD, and then kind of go from there.
Getting all the way to a PhD could be a very slow process, because the reality of Ronnie's life is that he is always in pain.
A lot of people have this idea that's actually been voiced to me, where they think that the worst part about being in this wheelchair is that I can't stand up. They have no idea how much pain I experience on a daily basis. They don't realize how debilitating, you know, my GI problems can be, bladder problems can be, hygiene. My bones have deformed over time, being stuck in this chair.
But he didn't give up on school, he didn't give up on scuba, and he didn't give up on being a good person. All of his frustrations are not just about him. They're about other people in the disability community.
And I just kind of wish, and it goes across the board from other people to ourselves, but I just really wish people could be kinder, nicer to one another, to ourselves. Stop holding on to all of these things, traditions, ideologies that have no value and do nothing for us other than causes hardship. Yeah. So just having people be a little more compassionate, empathetic, and understanding.
This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.